Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Could DNA reveal you're the long-lost relative of an ancient king?
How many Anglo-Saxons were in Britain when the Romans left?
And how do you stop significant archaeological finds getting stolen?
The answers to your questions on the Time Team podcast.
Welcome to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek, and this episode is all about your questions.
Yeah, and I know that you love answering the questions that our Patreon supporters have, don't you, Helen?
I do.
Because as you very often say, it gives you a unique and a new way of looking at things that sometimes you hadn't considered.
Absolutely, yes. If you keep just running along your own tracks, asking yourself the same old questions, you'll never branch out and see other things. So you absolutely need people to be asking questions. And that's where people who work in universities, they have their students. I don't work in a university. I need the Patreons to ask me questions.
So thank you so much for doing that. And if you want to ask a question, by the way, Patreon's the way to do it. We've got a nice little chat going now, so people contribute to it. And occasionally I'll write a few things on there and I'll say, do you maybe have a question about such and such or this or that? And people go, oh, yeah, I'm interested in that, and get involved. And it's a big old community with the podcast, which is exactly what we wanted to create. You can join it by supporting us there, patreon.com/timeteamofficial. And we've got a few questions. We also have Helen's find coming up in this episode as well, where Helen brings an interesting object from history, from archaeology, that maybe tells a story, that tells us something about life in times gone by. We will get to that in a moment, but first to question number one, and it comes from Rebecca Clark. Hi, Rebecca, who says, my question is, do we know how far back in history people have been interested in archaeology? What a brilliant question. That is so good. Has it only really been since the antiquarians in the 1800s? A great question, Helen.
It is, and I think everybody has got a slightly different take on this one. But for me, I think it's been since whenever you feel that intellectual inquiry that isn't centred on religion began. So in the medieval period, if you had a question that we might answer through science, in those days they tended to answer it through working out what God was doing in order to cause this. So, you know, what makes the weather, what makes a natural disaster, why dogs have waggy tails, all that kind of stuff. It would have been answered by saying that that's because that's how God made it, that's what God wants. And you use the inquiry around the natural world or the scientific world or whatever to tell you more about God. That was the aim, to find out more about God. But then since the Enlightenment, a different way of thinking about things came about. It was slightly different to the antiquarians of the 1800s, because I think that was really when people began to think, what do these archaeological remains actually mean in terms of previous people who lived in our island or who lived in the place that you're researching? So you might come across a great ancient city and think, well, who lived in that and when? Or you might come across an ancient grave and think, who was buried in that and when? And it was all scientific inquiry by that point. Then there was this really interesting gap in between where we're not quite sure whether we should call them the first archaeologists or just philosophers who used archaeology to further a different line of inquiry. Not what does this say about God, but what does this tell us about human beings? And I'm actually really interested in that. Now, you know, what we choose to think about archaeology, how we choose to interpret it, says more about us than it does about the past. But we don't say this explicitly. But in the 17th century, a few people did. And one of those was Sir Thomas Browne, who was a doctor, a medical doctor. He lived in Norwich, so he was an East Anglian, or at least an East Anglian by adoption. So I'm very keen on him. and he wrote books about philosophy as well as having a medical practice. And one of his books was called Urn Burial. Sometimes it's known by, I think it's the Greek title, which is Hydria Taphia, which means burial in urns. And then the subtitle is A Discourse on the Sepulchral Urns Lately Found in Norfolk. So this was a cremation cemetery, an Anglo-Saxon cremation cemetery, slightly similar to the more famous Spong Hill, or maybe like the cremation cemetery that we've been working on at Sutton Hoo. It's now a lost site. He says it was near Great Walsingham and nobody knows where it was. But he's writing it up, not as an archaeological report, not as an inquiry as to who's buried in these urns, where they've come from, what date they are, what their cultural affinities are, etc. But it's more from the point of view of what they say about human mortality, how they speak to us about human mortality and funeral customs in general. So it's a very different funeral custom from what he was used to in the 17th century when there was no cremation at all. So instead of researching Anglo-Saxon cremation, he's musing on what it means about the way we treat our dead and what it says about humans in general. Now, I just think that's such a wonderful and different way to look at it. So he's one of my early ones, but there is also the fact that people did find things, objects, that they couldn't explain. And one of the big ones are worked flints. People would pick up worked flints and have very little idea about who made them, why and how. And things like flint arrowheads, we find them in later contexts where they've been clearly kept or curated and valued because of their beauty and their strangeness. But people didn't know what they were, and they were generally given supernatural explanations. So there was this concept of being elf shot. A horse could be elf shot. There are explanations in Anglo-Saxon manuscripts about what to do if your horse has been elf shot. I don't know very much about it, except that I gather that one of the explanations for these flint arrowheads was that they were the shot of the elves. It's also mentioned in some witch trials in the 17th century. It's definitely supernatural. It's not connected with Christianity. They're so strange that they're thought to be the work of elves. And so people were conscious of old, strange things, but it was less that they were old and more that they were just so other that they weren't to do with our society.
Isn't that interesting? And it means that they were thinking about it, even if they hadn't quite necessarily got the right idea of what it was.
Well, they've got a different idea, haven't they?
Yeah, a different idea, you're right.
An idea that helps us to know about those people, and our ideas help us to know about us.
Yes, I've always thought now, ever since I heard you said it the first time, and you say it fairly often, which is that how much archaeology informs us about ourselves because of what we choose to investigate, why we choose to investigate it, what our conclusions might be, tells us more about us than it does necessarily about the people that we were trying to find out more about. And that has always intrigued me, especially at Sutton Hoo. Let's move on to the second question. Thank you, Rebecca. That was brilliant.
Thank you.
Really, really good. Charlie has a question, and it's about DNA and this the kind of ancestry websites and things that you can go on. And I like this. When DNA is extracted from human remains, says Charlie, is it possible to run it through services like Ancestry.com? And there are loads of others, aren't there? But Ancestry.com is one of them, to check for any matches. Personally, says Charlie, I think it would be way more exciting to find out that I'm a genetic match to an ancient Anglo-Saxon than to discover I share DNA with a random fourth cousin. Well, I mean, true, right? Imagine that. You go on that website and you put in all your DNA information. You have to give a swab, don't you, I think? And they take it off to the lab and then they come back and they say, yes, you're related to this king that we dug up.
Yes, but it doesn't really work like that. And the trouble is, it's the way that the DNA works. Now I don't even have an O level in biology, but this is how I understand it. The way that DNA splits, you know, it's a double helix, and so it kind of unwraps itself and splits off to form one half of your inheritance from one parent, and then it recombines with your other parent's DNA. So it randomly splits, and those two random halves recombine to form you. And because it's random, statistically speaking, apparently, and I have this on good authority from a geneticist, after 6 or 7 generations, you can share literally no DNA with one of your ancestors. And that takes some getting your head round, but that is the reason why only tiny bits are used for tracing ancestors. So it's only the Y chromosome which doesn't get involved in these recombinations. That is passed unchanged from man to man to man. If you've got a Y chromosome, you are a man. Or mitochondrial DNA, so that's the stuff that isn't in the nucleus, it's in the rest of the cell, and that's passed unchanged from woman to woman to woman. So if you want to trace your ancestors, you have to use those two bits because the rest of it is not reliable. So it's reliable for looking at your close relatives today, but it's not relevant, not reliable for looking back in time. And also, you can add to that I tried to do a bit of maths on this, and I'm sure that a proper mathematician needs to check what I've done, but I gather that after 9 generations, you've got over 1,000 ancestors, and all of those ancestors will probably have had more descendants than just you. And then after 38 generations, which I've chose 38 because I think it's the number of generations between Alfred the Great and King Charles III, if I have got my maths right, the number of ancestors that you theoretically have, you know, if all your two parents are obviously different to each other, and your 4 grandparents are obviously all different to each other, and probably your 8 great-grandparents are, but you could actually have cousin marriages that would mean that you don't have as many ancestors as theoretically possible. But the number of ancestors that is theoretically possible, I think, is 275 trillion. And that is clearly more than the whole population of the Earth. So obviously, we're all related to each other statistically. And it's been suggested by the geneticist Adam Rutherford that just about every person with British descent somewhere in their background will be descended from Edward III because he had so many descendants. I think we've seen from the television programme where Who Do You Think You Are? That they've taken several quite random people and shown individually that they all descend from Edward III in one way or another. They might continue through the royal line later. They might split off at the moment of a son or daughter of Edward III. But these are quite random cases. Now, some people have argued against this, saying that the royalty and the aristocracy only marry each other. But that's absolutely not true. There are always younger children of younger children. And social mobility goes both ways. People move up, but they also move down. So I know I'm descended from Edward III. And
yeah,
with
and isn't
a bit
Danny
of digging,
Dyer also descended from Edward III? He was descended from some king or other, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. And I know that with a name like Williams, it's a bit more challenging than with a name like Geek.
It's very challenging.
But I bet we could find out if we did a bit of digging that you're descended from Edward III. So in a way, you know, to summarise it really, we're all related to an ancient Anglo-Saxon. We're all related to an Anglo-Saxon king. And in fact, logically, that means we're all descended from Woden, because they're all descended from Woden, apparently, according to their family tree. The thing is, though, that it's so complicated to work out the exact line of descent that you might not be able to find that out without help from a television programme.
Right.
And incidentally, if you are watching Who Do You Think You Are, you must continue to the credits, because there's a lot of overlap, particularly on the camera side, between Time Team's cameramen and Who Do You Think You Are cameramen. So you can often see a familiar name popping up.
We only have the best of the best. Only the best of the best. Well, what a disappointing answer, because I really wanted to be related.
Special.
I wanted to be special. That's it. I wanted to be special. But actually, you know, we're all special. We're all related.
We're all special. And the take-home message from this is that the amount of royal blood that runs through your veins or my veins is no more than the amount of, in inverted commas, royal blood that runs through the veins of the royal family today. It's all absolutely random and it's got nothing to do with DNA.
But it also means that I'm also related to all the rotters and the horrible ones as well, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. Nobody likes to think about that.
Mm, great.
Yes.
Well, there we go. That was very interesting. Very interesting indeed. And thank you so much, Charlie, for the question. Right, more questions coming in just a moment, but let's pause now to do Helen's Find. Now, this is the bit of the podcast where Helen, in her role as a finds liaison officer or just a general interesting person who is an archaeologist, comes across objects and the stories that they can tell. So what are you bringing to the metaphorical table for this podcast episode, Helen?
Well, apologies if I've done this before because I am absolutely obsessed with seal matrices. But as we talked about seals on the last podcast and about how they were owned by both women and by ordinary people, I thought we ought to have a look at a good example of this. And it's a small lead seal matrix, which is a kind of oval shape, and it was recorded in Surrey by one of my colleagues. So we can put the database number and the link up on the website, can't we, Martin? And everybody will be able to find it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So a seal matrix is this small piece of metal. It's flat in this instance, and it has a little loop on the back so that once you've pushed it into your wax, you can pick it up again. And you push them into wax to authenticate a document. So the seal, it's not so much that it's sealing it closed, like, say, a 19th century seal might close the envelope of a document. They can do that, but they're also almost like just like a signature, that you press your seal into it so that even if you can't write, you can do this. You hold your seal on you and you print it. It's a bit like almost like a fingerprint. And the funny thing is, although I can talk about these things forever, so I'm going to digress in all sorts of directions. It is clearly printing. You know, you're taking a piece of metal which has got letters inscribed on it, and you're pushing it into wax, and you're repeating
and you're
it again and again and again.
And replicating and replicating.
And the important thing is, just like a signature, it's known and it's replicated. So sometimes somebody asks to borrow somebody else's seal because they say, my seal is not well recognised here, can I use yours? Which is really weird. So we don't really understand how they were seen. But because they're made of metal, the matrices that produce the seals, and they are very frequently lost, and they're frequently found by metal detectorists, we can begin to get some archaeology to add to the historical knowledge of seals. Now, this one, its loop on the back has been broken, so that's probably how it was lost. And on the front, it's got a very dull design, really. It's got a kind of leaf or branch or maybe an ear of wheat in the centre. And around it, it is the seal of Joan. So that is, I'm just going to get the picture of it up, so I can have an absolutely solid look at it. Yes, there we go. So it's Seal of Joan, which is Johanna. So that's the female version of John. Then it says Le, and then it says Smith. So it's Joan Smith, yes, but it's Joan the Smith. So it's one of the quarter of all seal matrices that we know were owned by women. The workmanship is terrible, so we can infer from that it was fairly cheap. And the fact that she's called Joan the Smith implies that she's actually doing that job rather than that she's just inherited the surname from, say, her husband or her father, married into it and has inherited it from her father or her grandfather. It's a 13th century seal matrix, so it's just at the point when surnames are becoming heritable, but they're not strictly heritable at this point. This is the point where it's all crystallizing into an inherited name. So if you've got an interesting name like Baker or Miller or Smith or Taylor, it probably means that your ancestor in the male line in the 13th century was one of those. But Joan is probably a Smith herself because she's got this Joan the Smith rather than just Joan Smith. So she's a woman doing a hard job And she's not earning a great deal of money, or having, she hasn't got a lot of prestige from this job. It's not a status-seeking seal. It's a perfect little vignette of a woman who could be a Smith. Now, I'm not saying that this is common. We've actually only got two seals out of the 7,000 we've got on the database that show a woman and the surname Smith. The other one is Eliana Lefebvre. So she's a Smith in a French accent. Fevre meaning French, Smith in French.
French Smith.
Whereas the number we've got that say things like, we've got women's seals that say wife of, and all sorts of other by names, as they're called. Let me have a look at my little list of them. The commonest, of course, are just the patronymic. So we get Isabella, son of Richard, say, for instance. We also have some that show that somebody's a widow. Very occasionally we have a sister, so somebody's sister of somebody else. There's a lot of place names, so somebody like Matilda of the Wood. And we've got nicknames. Now, my surname is a typical nickname one, Helen the Fool. But these occupation ones...
No.
I know. These occupation ones, then there's not very many of them. There's only actually 6% of them have occupation names. But they're among the most interesting. And they show that women, they might not have done this very often, but they could have these jobs and they could be known by these jobs. So it sheds light both on literacy and on social class and on the way that women see themselves and are seen by others. Just this one little object tells us so much in conjunction with all the other 7,000 seal matrices. It's such a wonderful field of inquiry. And this kind of, you know, all these 7,000 are there on the Portable Antiquities Scheme database for anybody to download and have a look at. So you might be able to find your own patterns.
And what I'll do is I'll put the link to the specific one that we're talking about. There's a link to finds.org.uk. I'll put that in the description. So you just go and click the link and it will take you to the exact object that Helen's talking about. This is the Time Team Podcast, Martin Williams and Dr. Helen Geek, and it's all about your questions in this episode that you've submitted on Patreon. Thank you so much for doing that, and I will just say again, if you want to ask a question in a future edition of the podcast, you get the opportunity to join our chat if you are a Patreon supporter. Patreon.com/Time Team Official. That's not the only thing that you get to do. There are so many extra videos, opportunities to volunteer with Time Team, extended interviews. So some of the interviews that we do on the podcast, you can usually watch an extended version of that conversation, all there for you on Patreon, patreon.com/Time Team Official. Let's move on to question number three. This comes from Robert. Now, Robert, your surname, I'm probably going to pronounce wrong, so I'm sorry about that. Robert Boudreau, are we saying? B-O-U-D-R-E-A-U. Very nice name. I know there's still the ongoing controversy about when and how the Anglo-Saxons came to Britain, says Robert. With so much trade during Roman times coming through the Rhine, and the Romans' habit of using soldiers and auxiliaries from other parts of the empire, what's the current feeling about how many Germanic people may have already been in Britain when the Romans left? And this always confuses me, Helen, is the, it sounds really simple, but it's the timeline of when things happened. Because you say the Romans, and I can picture the Romans going about doing Roman things. And you say the Anglo-Saxons, and I can picture them going about doing Anglo-Saxon things and dragging boats up mounds and all of that sort of stuff. But when you ask me, right, so which one came first and how many hundreds or thousands of years was it before this and the other one? And that's where I start to get very confused. And the thought that there might be overlap is obviously something that must have happened. There must have been a time where there were these peoples sort of coexisting with one another, but it sort of doesn't work with my little brain. It likes to compartmentalize these people. So this would be a very, very interesting question to hear the answer to.
Well, I think you're right about that, Martin, that we do tend to think about it in a compartmentalized way. And I think one of the problems is that we often learn about this stuff very, very early on in primary school. For some reason, we seem to feel that history should be taught chronologically. So when you're five, you start with the well, the book that I had was called Cavemen to Vikings. And by the time you get to 14, you've reached the Second World War, which means that when we're talking about the Romans and the Anglo-Saxons, you're usually about seven. And so it's taught in a very simple way so that you can understand it or at least get some grasp. You feel that the country is empty, and then the Romans come and they live here for a while and then they go away again. And then the Anglo-Saxons come and they live here for a while and then they go away again. And then the Normans come. And then that's the beginning of proper history of the 1066. And however much we know that's wrong, it's somehow so deeply ingrained within us that we find it difficult to imagine how Roman Britain turns into Anglo-Saxon England. And this is also compounded by the fact that when you think of a Roman, you're probably thinking of, I think we discussed this when we were talking about Pompeii, you're probably thinking of something that happened in Rome in the first century AD. That's the classic moment of legionaries and mosaics and frescoes and villas and all that kind of stuff, and wine and olives and it all being lovely.
Yeah, but of course that Roman, the person who was living then, wouldn't even register at all to a Roman at the end of the Roman Empire. It'd be so far in history, so many generations would have passed, they wouldn't even know their name or that they even existed.
No, it's a bit like the difference between us and Shakespeare. It's acres of time. So what we've got to do is try to remember what's going on in the late Roman period. And what's happening here in Britain in the late Roman period, certainly, is that we've got quite a lot of evidence for Germanic settlers, as Robert says. So we have the odd grave that's got Germanic-looking belt sets, and we have Germanic-looking pottery and so on. And it seems as if Germanic fashions are quite trendy at the end of the Roman Empire, that it's a new way of doing your art and your fashions. Germanic things and your pottery, Germanic things are just all the rage, you know. So it's quite difficult to tell who is properly Germanic and who is just wearing the belt buckle and eating off the pottery. What we always want to go for then is DNA, and that is also quite... we're not at the stage with the DNA where we can say this. So Robert's asking quite a new and interesting question, actually, because the question that's usually asked is how many people lived in Roman Britain when at the end of Roman Britain? And we have been able to work that out from the density of settlements that are occupied at the end of the Roman Empire, and it's thought to be around 4 million people. So that's much the same as just before the Black Death and just before the Industrial Revolution. So it's generally, that's when agricultural Britain is full at 4 million people. If you don't have cities, if you don't have fossil fuels, it's difficult to sustain more than 4 million people. The next question is often, how many people must have arrived from northern Germany and those kinds of areas to precipitate that collapse of Roman culture or to take advantage of it? How many people arrived to give us Anglo-Saxon England? And that's often been suggested as, well, people guess for a start, because they think, well, how many people do you need to change language, for example, and they factor in a few diseases and things. And more recently, people have started trying to use DNA to work these things out. The first attempt that was done with modern DNA, so looking at proportions of different kinds of DNA within English in different places in England, and that produced one result. More recently, we've been using ancient DNA, which has produced a staggeringly different result. And the problem with the ancient DNA is we just haven't got enough samples. We're arguing at the moment from things like, well, a lot of samples might from a single site might be 10. A lot of samples for a single study might be 40. These numbers just aren't enough to be representative. So as with so much in archaeology... Well, do you know the light bulb joke about archaeology? Have I told you this before?
Tell it me again and I'll tell you if I've heard
How
it.
How many archaeologists does it take to change a light bulb?
Do you know what? This is the first ever thing that you said on our first ever podcast.
Oh, is it?
It is.
I do repeat myself.
It's the first ever thing. Well,
I do remember. It is because you said, do you know any jokes about archaeology? And I told you this one. Yeah. Well, you have to remember that the number of archaeologists it takes to change a light bulb is we don't know. We haven't got enough evidence yet. And that's exactly the same as with how many Germanic people may have already been in Britain when the Romans left. We simply don't know because we haven't got enough evidence yet. And I'm sorry that that's a cop-out, but it's quite a new question. People haven't been asking it for very long, and they certainly haven't been able to answer it for very long.
So is there an answer to how many people they estimate would have been needed to, that sort of the minimum number that they would have needed to change the language of 4 million people?
Well, you can bring in plague and maybe wipe out half the population, so that'll take you down to 2 million, and then by doomsday, which is the next moment when we've got a secure population estimate, that's about 2 million again. And then it's really how long is a piece of string. You might say, well, you'll need 1 million people to effect language change, and then you might look at the ships and see how many people they contain with the people needed to row or sail them. How many ships could be arriving with how many people? Is it likely that in 50 or 100 years you could get, say, 500,000 or 1 million people across? There are lots of debates about that. But in the end, we're probably asking the wrong question, because if you look at other places where language has overtaken, language has changed very thoroughly, that sometimes there aren't any population changes. The loss of Cornish is one. There's very little population change in Cornwall, and yet everybody within a couple of generations stops speaking Cornish because that's what you have to do to get on. Then we have quite a lot of people coming over in the Norman Conquest, and we don't have any or very little language change. The answer seems to be it's more complicated than that, and it's to do with how stable and successful your culture is. So if late Roman Britain is already beginning to collapse, nobody's wanting to pay their taxes, nobody's mending the roads, the pottery factories are falling apart, there's no money left, then maybe just a few very influential people can do it. So in answer to your question, it's anything between a few tens of thousands and 1 million, which doesn't really narrow it down very much.
No, it doesn't narrow it down a huge amount, does it? But I like the journey to get there. Very, very interesting. And thank you so much, Robert. That is a brilliant, brilliant question. We have time for one more. It comes from Jacob Beezer, who says, since time team is, so this is more sort of logistics time team related question. Since time team is a program that often provides live events as well as audience engagement, are there any provisions in place if a find is significant enough to require temporary secrecy while the finding is secured? So this is, I suppose, if we come across something like, I don't know, something really, really important. Let's say we went to, well, actually, let's not use Sutton Hoo because we can't really tell you a lot about what we necessarily find or what we don't find. But let's say we go to a site and we find something absolutely amazing. This is world-changing, this find that we have come across in the ground. Then what do we do? Because if we let the cat out of the bag, then maybe somebody would come and steal it or damage it, or there'd be a worry. So what's the process of trying to sort of keep things quiet and keep things safe and secure?
Well, it's not a problem that's restricted to time team. There's lots of sites that are discovered which can't be excavated in the day, and there's something that could either really be vulnerable to theft, or more often it's that people think that there's something that they could steal and then they go and damage the archaeology. So just digging a hole is as damaging as digging a hole and stealing something a lot of the time. And we have things like we have Harris fencing, which can be locked, and that's about as secure as you can get for the opportunistic thief. But also several sites do these days have to pay for security, and there are CCTV cameras. On time teams, we often have security not just for the site, but also because we're often leaving things like scanners and printers and laptops, and well, maybe not laptops, but a lot of equipment, screens on site overnight. And so we have somebody who sits there in the dome and acts as our security. I mean, a proper professional who does security for us for the whole thing. So that is what is also replicated on some archaeological sites where there's something very specific. It's often the early Anglo-Saxon cemetery because people know that women are buried in their clothes, men are buried with their weapons. And while a piece of iron might not go for much, some women's jewellery can be very, very valuable. So it is vulnerable to being stolen. But there's another thing, you know, it's not just... One of the problems is not just security, so physically stopping any rotter getting in and stealing things. There's also the idea of confidentiality in that we want to let out the information in the right way sometimes. And we've got different layers of confidentiality depending on what's appropriate, really. So when we were at Sutton Hoo, we were positively welcoming visitors. You know, nothing was screened off. You could come into the dome, see us all working. But we didn't give out all the information that we could. We didn't give out every single bit. I'm not going to obviously say an example of what we kept to ourselves because it will be available in the finished programmes. Mm-hmm. But we would tell the visitors a bit more than we might, say, put on social media, and explain that we didn't want the news to leak out in advance. And that was particularly the case with the bucket. It was very obvious to any visitor last year what was going on, because you could see the bucket emerging from the very top, emerging from the ground, and then you could see that we were lifting it in a block and taking it away. But we didn't want a running commentary on it. So we partly exist in order to tell stories about the archaeology, and we want to be able to tell our story first. We don't want it to get out in a way that we want to make it and release it. We don't want somebody else to take all our ingredients and make the story from that.
Yeah. There is one way, of course, of getting the information first, which is, Helen,
to become a Patreon, because you do definitely get a bit more there.
Yeah.
Because our Patreons are really, they're part of the community, aren't they? And we all trust them not to put it immediately on social media.
Absolutely. There we go. That whole question was just one big sell. No, it wasn't at all. It was a great question, Jacob, actually. And it's something that's good to think about, isn't it? The kind of logistics of how we do archaeology as well. Being a Patreon supporter is a very good idea, though, and it allows you to ask questions of Helen on a future edition of the podcast, which is very much what we would like you to do. So if you want more details as to how to sign up, where you need to go and everything, it's just a simple website, patreon.com/timeteamofficial, or you can download the app, search for Time Team, you'll find us there. That's all we have time for this week. What's on the podcast next week? I was a bit of a surprise, really, as things stand at the moment, which is code for me saying, not quite sure at this stage.
Busy, haven't we, with the whole of Sutton Hoo and everything. We've been absolutely racing, chasing our tail. So, yes, let's have take a day off, Martin, and then start thinking about it.
Okay, I'll do that. But rest assured, it will be something very interesting, which you will enjoy learning about. I have no doubt of that. Thank you for your company, and we'll see you again on another Time Team podcast. Bye.
Bye.
To modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.